It's hard to think about the benefits of a forest fire when it's bearing down on your house or filling the air with smoke. But fire is a natural part of the life cycle of forests, and it's one that got pushed aside for many years in favor of fire suppression. Foresters and environmentalists like to remind people of the many benefits of fire in the forest. Oregon Wild Executive Director Sean Stevens joins us to lay those out. Sean Stevens, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the really broad question for people who might not know all of the reasons. In what ways are wildfires beneficial?
Well, all of our forests grew up with wildfire. Many species rely on fire to replenish the forest and renew it. And it's only recently, as we've really developed into the forest and had more communities surrounding the forest, that we've been more concerned about suppressing these fires. And they can range from the small ones that burn just on the floor of the forest to even big fires in western Oregon that today we're really concerned about, but previously that's really what was the lifeblood of the forest.
We had, of course, some strikes last night, and we've had numerous forest fires this summer across southern Oregon and northern California. Thinking about just one in particular, the Beaver Complex, you're dealing with an urban boundary there. When you're talking about dealing with wildfires, how do you distinguish between where you should fight a fire and where you shouldn't? Obviously, if it's threatening homes, that's one thing, but there's got to be a gray area between the two, isn't there?
Well, certainly, and as I mentioned, I think one of the things that has happened over the course of the last 50 years, and it's a continuing trend, in Oregon perhaps a little bit less so than in neighboring states because of our strong land use laws, is you've seen more and more development going out into the backcountry. And that's where it gets tricky, because if you really have a community that's close to the forest, it's going to make sense to do what we can to fight fires close to those communities to save people and property. But when we start getting out into far-flung areas, we really have to think about the cost-benefit of those efforts.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the types of forest that we have here. Of course, there is some old-growth forest. What are some advantages of preserving old growth?
Well, old growth tends to have the big trees with the big, thick bark, and those tend to be the most fire-resistant that we have out on the landscape. And so even if you had fire go through an area like that, you wouldn't see it burn through as intensely, or it certainly wouldn't have complete mortality in those areas, because these big old trees can resist those fires, all but the hottest fires and the fires that really get into the crown of the forest, the top of the forest. Those old growth will survive. And so we used to have a much broader dispersal of old growth than we do today because of logging, and those forests tend to help fire be a little bit less severe, and certainly help the fire maintain itself more ecologically.
I was reading somewhere that old growth is really good at storing carbon, but new growth, if that's the right term for it, is good at absorbing carbon. If left alone, I assume that forests are probably going to figure out their own good ratio, but do we have a process in place for helping that along if necessary?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because when we think about forests, we can just think about what's good for the forest out there. But we also, in today's world, we have to think about climate change and global warming and how our forest management impacts this big global problem. We're lucky here in the Pacific Northwest, specifically with our old growth forests. They store and capture more carbon than any other terrestrial ecosystem on Earth. That includes the Amazonian rainforest and anything else. The oceans do a pretty good job, but as far as on land, our old growth forests are pretty amazing. And it's true that some of the young forests, as they grow, suck in some carbon and do so at a fast rate. What we've found, and a lot of research at Oregon State University has shown, is that old-growth forests, they tend to act like these big pumping machines that take carbon from the air and gradually funnel it down into the soil. So not just in the branches and the trunk, but also putting it into the soil. And so even this new research has shown that even with that fast uptick of carbon for young forests, old growth is still doing that job. And this is that balance between trying to figure out how to manage a forest for carbon sequestration. In some places, it's obvious that we really don't want to do anything because, as you said, the forest is figuring it out for us and doing a great job. And in other places, there might be a role to do some careful thinning, but we have to weigh those consequences for carbon, because any time you log, you're going to have some carbon output.
Cynthia joins us from Talent with a question about air quality. Go ahead, Cynthia.
Yeah, I was just thinking that sounds like the management management of fire is leaning towards fire being a norm for our summers here. And if that is the case, then are there plans to factor that air pollution into the particulate allowed in our air here in the valley? It seems like it seems like there's already such an overload in terms of particulate that when you add forest fires to that, it's just really hard for people who live here.
Sean?
Yeah, Cynthia, it's a good point that when we think about forest fires as ecologically good, of course, there's the actual flames that might threaten people or structures, but then you have the air quality and all of the smoke that gets put out by these fires. And of course, when these fires were burning 300, 400 years ago, we didn't have the same sized communities. We didn't have these places that could suffer from the air quality impacts. And so I think you're right that as the Department of Environmental Quality goes forward, and in a world where there's a good chance that we might have more fire because of climate change, that we're going to have to start thinking about air quality measures from other sources when we consider fire and that total suite of air quality impactors. Unfortunately, with forest fire, you know, there's not a lot that you can do. If a fire is burning, one, we have pretty limited ability to try to put it out. Despite our best efforts, usually forest fires are stopped by the weather changing, rain coming in, winds dying down, humidity going up. That means that smoke is going to be something that we're going to have a hard time corralling as well, and we're going to have to take that into consideration going forward.
I know that inversions play a factor in this sometimes in terms of air quality, and we have an email from Bruce in Happy Camp. His question is somewhat related to that. He'd like to know when the best time is for prescribed burning of natural forests in southern Oregon or northern California, how much rain needs to fall, what other factors are used in giving the go-ahead on fires. He points out that Native Americans had a long history of burning, and this season shows him how much more we need to burn. He says late fall seems to be better than spring for the animals involved. Your thoughts on that's quite a few questions, but your thoughts on some of that?
Yeah, I guess I'll start by saying I'm not being an expert in prescribed burns. I think that I heard it right in the question there, that there are a couple of different times of year when you have enough room for the fire to go through the forest floor. Over snow is not going to work very well. But in that springtime or the fall time, when you can rely on enough moisture in the air and the temperatures aren't so hot, you do see the Forest Service and other agencies doing these prescribed burns. And I think one thing to note with prescribed burning as a tool to reintroduce fire to the landscape where we have suppressed fire, because really that's what we're talking about with prescribed burns is, there are many places across Oregon, Northern California, Washington, where because we fought fire so much, these areas might have missed fire cycles. In eastern Oregon, where the fire cycles are more frequent, you could have fire going through every 15, 20 years. They were low-intensity fires, but when we knocked those fires down and kept them away for 50, 60, 80 years, there's a little bit more fuel there, and so we want to try to put prescribed fire back into kind of reset and get us back to that normal state. But that's a little bit different from what Native Americans typically were doing out on the landscape with fire. That was mostly used as a tool for managing the landscape to create areas for agriculture. Lots of the Willamette Valley, for example, was oak savanna that was burned down intentionally to create more room for cropland.
We have John on the line from Eugene. Go ahead, John.
I was just wondering if there is information when the explorers first came in, were there large tracts that had been burned, you know, that had obviously burned, including the old growth? When I go hiking now, you'll often hike through something that is all the way burned, even in the old growth section. Was that common, or is that more, more common now than it used to be?
what fire records indicate, and typically how researchers go about this, is they can core trees to get an idea of when fire came through because they can see it in the core sample. And what I have seen in the research is that those big fires, even in the old growth, they would happen, but typically, especially in Western Oregon, you're looking at a much longer fire regime, 200, 300 years old, where those fires happen with that frequency and they're that big. And we've had some in more recent memory of big fires. Unfortunately, some of them have been caused not by natural lightning strike, but by human error. And so you know, the Tillamook burn is a big classic example of a large fire that burned through a wet Western Oregon site.
Also joining us from Eugene is Ann. Go ahead, Ann.
Thank you. So I was vacationing this spring over in Deschutes County, and I was horrified to see large subdivisions being allowed away from sisters out in Ponderosa and Lodgepole dry forests that are going to burn sooner or later. You know, the county doesn't have any risk because they get money from building permits, they get money from property taxes, but it's just setting up a situation where firefighters are going to be out there risking their lives to protect somebody's house where there should never have been allowed to have these dispersed subdivisions and dispersed housing in the first place. Thank you.
Well, I think Anne's getting at something that we talked about earlier, and that's that gray area. When is it appropriate to fight fire to save property? And if the property has been built in a spot that is a high fire risk spot, it gets harder and harder to justify that. And Anne points something else out that's important is that typically the fire costs are not borne, the firefighting costs are not borne by the local governments. It's the Oregon Department of Forestry and then a lot of money that comes from the federal government. And there's been some efforts to reform how firefighting spending happens because it's severely depleted the Forest Service revenue each year that they're able to spend on other good projects like recreation and other things that the public really wants them to spend money on.
I kind of have a broad question related to that. Last year, I interviewed some people about the bark beetle problem up near Crater Lake, and we got into a bit of a discussion about when something is a human-caused problem, does that require a human solution, or can we allow just a natural solution to some of these problems? I wonder what your thoughts might be on that, at least in terms of forestry.
Excellent question. Really interesting. I think, you know, so I guess what the thought is that bark beetles, natural occurrence in the landscape, they happen, have happened for centuries. But right now with climate change, we may be giving them the opportunity to have more of an impact than they would have historically. And there's some competing evidence out in the landscape, both in Oregon and in neighboring western states for that theory. But certainly the idea is that if something that we do causes an impact, do we have the responsibility, or is the best path something for us to do to fix it? And I think that we have to be careful. You know, there is that old John Muir quote that's I think when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find that it's bound by a fast 1,000 invisible cords that cannot be broken. The idea that one thing that we mess with in nature is going to have ripple impacts. And so if we try to fix our mistakes, sometimes we create new mistakes. And we've seen that not just in Oregon, but across the world with many of our ecological blunders. So sometimes it's hard for us to do, but giving nature time is almost always the best course.
I wanted to make sure we spend a little time talking about Glaze Meadow. I remember reading about this a few years ago, and I was wondering what the status of that is today. Is that still deemed to be a successful project?
Yeah, so Glaze Meadow is a project that Oregon Wild started. It was actually our our recently passed staff member, Tim Willebeau, who worked for Oregon Wild for 40 years, and he was a champion for Eastern Oregon Forests, and he decided that he'd try with the Forest Service to actually design a timber sale, something that was not exactly in the Oregon Wild wheelhouse. We were used to filing lawsuits against timber sales, not designing them on our own. But we saw this forest that was right next to the Black Butte development in Central Oregon. It had missed fire cycles. It had been grazed. Some high-grade logging of the big old trees had happened. And Tim said, "Hey, we can take this place, do some thinning, do some mixed thinning in different places, leave some skips and gaps, try to mimic what would have happened from a history of continual fire." And over the course of the last 10 years, that has been developed, and the project's been implemented. I think that the last units have been logged, and we won't know. It's kind of the test of those projects that you see it long term. You don't get to see the benefits in the immediate time scale. But we view it as a success, and it's been the model for a lot of the work that's happened in Ponderosa Pine Forest in the rest of Eastern Oregon to try to restore them to health.
Well, assuming that it is successful in the long run, is this something that can be implemented widely, or was this stand of timber, this area, so unique that it's not something you could do very often?
Well, it's certainly not so unique that it can't be done more widely. The issue that we run up against quite frequently is that you have one good idea for one place, and many of our elected leaders want to assume that that's the thing that we can put as the solution across every bit of the landscape. And if we did it here in a small way, then more is better, and even more is better the next year. And we have to, as I said, we have to be really cautious with some of these things, because our understanding tends to be limited in our ability to grasp things in the current time. You know, we learn more as we go. 10 years from now, we're going to know more about fire. We're going to know more about these ecosystems. And things that we do now, they could have unintended consequences. And so we're pushing forward with some of this restoration work in Eastern Oregon, but we typically promote some caution there because we know we've made some mistakes in the past, and we want to be careful not to do it again.
Living in the forest is a wonderful thing. Lots of people do that around here, but as we saw with the wildfires this summer, some folks lost their homes. What can people do to try to protect themselves?
Yeah, as you said, living in the forest is a wonderful thing. I think most people that live out far away, they live there because they love it, but they also understand the risks that are inherent. There are some simple things that can be done. The idea of defensible space, make sure that you're getting those fuels and small trees far enough away from your property that you have some ability to defend that space. Metal roofs do work wonders to prevent embers from falling on the roof and starting a fire. And so, that's just a couple of some of the simpler things that you can do if you do have a home out in the woods. But in the end of the day, I think everyone that has property out far-flung and in a fire-prone area has to realize that there's always that risk, and that's part of the wonder of living out in a place like that is that it's wild. It's not not tamed.
Clear cutting and salvage logging, I think these things are often branded, at least in the media, in a simplistic kind of way that they're always wrong. So I'm going to ask you, are they always wrong? Are there times, though, where clear cutting or salvage logging would be appropriate in a certain situation?
Well, salvage logging, the idea that you're going to go in and log areas after fire has gone through, that's been pretty well proven to be very harmful to the forest. There are some instances where Oregon Wild has worked out agreements on timber sales on federal land where, roadside hazard trees and other things, we've said, okay, go ahead, and that's a good idea. But if you're talking about in an area that's burned, typically areas have burned in a mosaic pattern, so there's lots of diversity in how hot the fire has been, so you're going to have complete regeneration in some areas. You're going to have a mix of trees that have survived in one area. going in and taking a broad brush and saying, okay, it's time to harvest what's valuable out of this burned over landscape, that's not going to be good long term. As far as clear cutting, it's a method, as the industry will tell you, it's the most efficient method for cutting down trees and getting money out of them. And so to the extent that clear cutting is ever appropriate, it's certainly not on our federal public lands that have multiple purposes beyond just what we can make a fast buck out of.
Do you think we're getting to a point where, going back to the model up near Sisters, do you think that that's the future, that we're going to get to that point in time where sides can come together, we can see less litigation?
Well, I think we have gone a long way. There already is less litigation. There's more agreement. I think the challenges come when we view these problems as something other than how best to manage forests, and we start overlapping other needs, as we see in Southwest Oregon, when we start talking about how does county funding fit into it. That's when things get complicated, because we're not going to be able to sustain the same level of harvest that we did in the 1980s that saw Jackson and Curry and other counties receiving a large windfall from the federal government. But that's the push, and that puts pressure on our ideas of forest management and what is best. Rather than leading with the science, leading with where there's common ground, we instead are going out in search of more money. And that's where it gets tricky. I think in Eastern Oregon we're seeing more agreement. But again, there's always forces at play that are trying to bring us back to the way we used to do things in the 80s. And hopefully we can charge ahead to the future and make that common ground more consistent.
A final question that I have this morning: are there some misconceptions, public perception about your organization or what you're trying to do that you'd like to address?
No, I don't think so. I think we've been around for, this is our 40th anniversary. Started as the Oregon Wilderness Coalition in 1974, and then we were ONRC, Oregon Natural Resources Council, until we changed our name in 2005 to Oregon Wild. I think people are pretty familiar with what we do, and the misperceptions are probably built up from ideology that is not something I'm going to be able to convince someone different of. But we work hard to make sure that there's an Oregon landscape out there for future generations that looks something like it does today.
We've been talking with Sean Stevens, the executive director of Oregon Wild, about the benefits of forest fire. Sean, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we will discuss whether city council seats should be paid positions. But first, we'll visit with Garrison Keeler and the Writer's Almanac. That's right after the break.